Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of recent disasters, setbacks, and reversals that has U.S. foreign policy blowing up in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Russia, Ukraine, Somalia, and Yemen. Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon and is the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan and the Politics of Intervention, and Kindred Rivals, America, Russia and Their Failed Ideals, joins us to discuss the failure upon failure of our foreign policies, particularly in the Middle East, where the legacy of the ill-fated Bush-Cheney intervention continues to haunt us. Then we'll look into the partisan folly in Washington that promises more gridlock, dysfunction, and possibly another government shutdown, only weeks after the new Republican majority in Congress promised that they were going to get things done. Veteran Capitol Hill staffer Mike Lofgren, who was a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees and is the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, joins us to discuss the ineptitude of House Speaker Boehner and the paralysis of Senate Majority Leader McConnell. Then finally, we'll examine the recent report by the National Academy of Sciences, Climate Intervention, and speak with Peter Frumhoff, the Director of Science Policy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where he is also Chief Scientist on Climate Change. We will assess the viability of proposals to inject millions of tons of sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight and cool the Earth, as well as less drastic and far more beneficial ways to reduce CO2 by using solar power in the third world to electrify rural areas and improve living standards and literacy. Joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And I spoke the other day with John Mearsheimer, who, along with Stephen Walt at Harvard, wrote the book about the Israel lobby that got a lot of attention. And he's been one of the few voices critical of the U.S. position over Crimea and by extension, Russia. And he went on to say, frankly, that if you look at the recent record of foreign policy, what have we got right? Iraq, Afghanistan, Crimea, ISIS, the whole thing is just, and Yemen just recently, and so on. It's like, you know, has anybody pulled back and really looked at recent foreign policy and wondered why it is that everything we've been touching lately has been a disaster?
Well, I think we have to have a bit of sympathy for the Obama administration, not that they haven't blundered in their own right, but they are very much suffering the sins of their forerunners. Of course, the instability in Syria and the rise of Islamic State and the general chaos in Iraq with that new government and the collapse of the army. All of that, of course, traces to a long history, not just the invasion of 2003 and its awful sequel, but certainly even to the sanctions of the Clinton years before that. This was a very much a systematic and systemic destruction of a society. You remember, Ian, you know, one could go to the old Iraq, visit a Baghdad where Shia and Sunni were living in the same neighborhoods. Often they were intermarrying. I mean, my goodness, I had friends who didn't know whether their neighbors were were Sunni or Shia. That's a world that has vanished completely in the rancor and bitterness and division that was quite deliberately exploited and furthered by the American attack and occupation and by policy since then. So Obama is paying here the wages of the past. in very many places, not just in the Middle East, of course, but also I was astounded to see the other day the White House say something about the success story in Somalia. That's hardly a success story. You're quite right. And Yemen is of course, come apart already at the seams. But even that one traces to a long and bitter history in which the supposedly terrorist forces that have taken over the country were once our allies against Nasser in the 1960s. You remember the Egyptian war in Yemen, where the Soviets and the Egyptians were on one side, and we and the Saudis, of course, were on the other. This is a long and bitter history that is virtually unknown, or at least unacknowledged, in the American political process. I saw Lindsey Graham the other day say, let's just do something in the Middle East because it will make me feel better. These people are evil and they're on the rise and they pose a threat to civilized society, and I can't feel good if the Americans are not doing, if my country is not doing something. Of course, what we have done in the past contributes mightily to the dilemma we face now.
But could it be, though, that we have so much political amnesia to forget, you know, how much George Bush and Dick Cheney are the cause of so much of what is going wrong in the world today, that the American people could elect George W. Bush's brother, Jeb, and he, of course, would bring Condoleezza Rice back. And in fact, my understanding is that the Republicans, a lot of Republicans, want to run Condoleezza Rice. But because she's tied to the Bush family, the idea is if Jeb doesn't make it, then she'd be the backup.
Well, I think it's amnesia in part. I'm not sure though that we can even forget something we didn't understand or see very clearly to begin with. I think it's quite possible that Jeb Bush could defeat Hillary Clinton. I think it's going to be a much closer race than anyone on the Democratic side is now assuming. And unless she pulls some kind of rabbit out of her old hat, some kind of new magical approach to foreign affairs, it's going to be a wilderness of mirrors there in which the two are very much competing for the hawkish vote, and Jeb Bush, I think, will quite easily out hawk her, and I think that's all too possible. But that, of course, will leave us even more with this incredible gap, this vacuum that we suffer in American politics in general, which is the understanding of what has happened here. Not just the reaction in the Middle East to an American invasion and to the violence that's been wrought over the last 10 to 15 years in terms of economic and political and military repression, but even before that, a long history of intervention and the perception on the part of these young people who you see in film clips and on YouTube and elsewhere rallying to the Islamists, volunteering to fight in Syria or in Iraq, who feel that not only has the West suppressed and savaged them militarily and politically, but we've done so culturally. We took away not only their livelihood and their sense of sovereignty and independence, but also their God. And I think that religious and cultural, that intellectual and, if you will, almost spiritual dimension to all of this means that it's going to be with us for a very long time. Indeed, I don't see much appreciation, Ian, of the depth or the breadth of that of that danger, of that challenge. We're of course debating now, will be debating in a sort of half-hearted and I think very shallow way further military intervention of some kind. John McCain wants more observers on the ground. He wants more spotters and more trainers and more special forces and more furtive hands behind the scene supposedly to defeat this threat, which he knows, he must know from his own experience in Vietnam, is not going to work. So boots on the ground are somewhere off in the in prospect here for either a Bush or a Clinton administration after 2016. So I think that this is a very long-term challenge. It's not going to go away anytime soon. And there's no sign that either the White House or the Congress, certainly not the Congress, or the public for that matter, has any kind of understanding of that deeper crisis.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is a comparative history of the inner politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. And the president, by the way, at a recent prayer breakfast, did try to at least put the role of religion in geopolitics. You just mentioned it in terms of the young Islamists in the diaspora joining the Islamic State, where he talked about the Crusades and about Jim Crow. And, of course, he got nothing but incredible backlash from the so-called religious right in this country, who simply do not obviously see the extraordinary comparisons between them and, the extent to which they are the American Taliban. So it's a very touchy subject, and of course it comes up in a way with the killing of these young Muslims in North Carolina. We don't quite know what the motives were, but this is what a typical NRA American, you know, he had guns and he was crazy and paranoid. But the sad part of it is that the people that were killed are the exemplars of how Islam and democracy can work here in the United States. In fact, one of the victims, a young woman, recently made a recording for NPR where she talked about that very issue, American freedom being compatible with Islam. So it just seems that at that core level, we can't have a serious discussion. And until we do, I don't think we'll understand what these forces arrayed against us.
I think that's true, and I the sad part of what Obama has said, what the White House has tried to introduce into the dialogue, is that it's always cast in terms of the contrast, the difference between the good Muslims and the bad Muslims, the fanatics, the radicals on one side, and the integrated, more secular, more westernized Islamic people on the other. That's who, of course, these North Carolina kids were. They're very much in the world of the Islamists anathema. They're the very reason for this revolt. The subversion, the seduction, the weaning away from the true faith of its sons and daughters by the material inducements and the false gods of the West. I think that Obama is quite right to try to make that distinction, try to draw that distinction for an American body politic that is still, after all, given to racism and xenophobia and all sorts of bigotry on the basis of what people wear, indeed the color of their skin and their faith and all the rest. On the other hand, this is a foreign policy problem, as I said earlier, that traces back rather directly in line to where America has put its priorities. It's the beginning of this whole Islamist phenomenon in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the Middle East, certainly in Egypt. Traces very much to American policies, not least to the American alliance, both open and covert with Saudi Arabia. It traces to the sheer hypocrisy of that policy. It's two-sided, two-faced dimensions. It is, as I said earlier, the toll of not just a few years of blunder and neglect and of savagery, but of decades. And I see no effort or even awareness in the body politic anywhere, and certainly not in the White House or the Department of State, the supposed repository of our history there. I see no evidence that we're ready to come to grips with that kind of thing. One can argue, Ian, precisely in terms of the North Carolina example, our good Muslims versus their bad Muslims, that what the Middle East needed, what it needs now, of course, is nothing less than a major Marshall Plan of vast proportions, that the rescue of these societies, even the ones that have sunk back into a worse authoritarianism than they had before, and I would count Egypt in that category. And in terms of chaos, certainly there are things worse than Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. We're seeing that, but nothing less than a massive modernization of the Islamic world is going to make any difference. The issues of poverty and of despair and of the sheer chaos that we introduced with the invasion of Iraq is still there and will be there for years to come. And of course, Syria is going to be an absolute example of entropy in the modern world. That's a civilization that will be in ruins for quite a while to come.
Well, in terms of a Marshall Plan to modernize the Middle East, it seems that there is a Marshall Plan underway, and has been for some time, from the Saudi Arabians, but it's the opposite of what you have called for. The Saudi Arabians are not spreading modernity, they're spreading medieval xenophobia through the Wahhabi religion. So that, you know, they're a part of the problem, surely.
Well, they're a part of the problem, and of course, America's bondage to Israel is a crucial part of the problem. There's just a desperate need for truth-telling and for honesty on all fronts, and the American political system finds that's beyond it in a number of ways. I would like to believe that in his last 2 years in office, that Barack Obama could bring a kind of candor and reflection and honesty to foreign policy and to his office that we have never seen there in Washington. But I don't find much hope there. I don't find much evidence that that's going to happen. I think he's still a very tactical president. I think this it disturbs him that he's going to go out as a war president, having been elected, having come in as someone who was going to end these wars. And I do think he is the victim of a dynamic over which he had a relatively little control. But then again, if for 6 years here, he's done virtually nothing to reverse that, but rather to incrementally further it. And I'm just afraid we're in for a very, very tough time. And when you look at the prospect of a Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton presidential race, it's not just yesterday's man, yesterday's woman. It is very much yesterday's governments waiting in the wings to come in. It's Condi Rice and all of the junior varsity of the W years, the neocons who would be granted, I think, much access. I mean, people talk about Brent Scowcroft and Bush 41 being the dominant influence on Jeb. I don't see that. I think that his brother is a stronger. People around his brother are stronger influences and more immediately on the scene than any of the old guard, as it were, from George H.W.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Roger Morris, let's turn to the Gordian knot of Russian relations and Crimea. Clearly, the Europeans have a different approach. They see things in terms of an analogy with World War I, the beginning of the Guns of August, through small events blowing up into catastrophic ones, whereas we're governed by the McCain's and Lindsey Graham's are governed by this idea of appeasement of Hitler. But it's not mutually exclusive. The expansion eastward of NATO is a catastrophe, but also Putin as a gangster running a mafia regime is also a catastrophe. So at the end of the day, do you just simply have to sell out the Ukrainians and wait for the Russians' new imperialists to gobble up too much, and then they'll have another fall like they did when the Soviet Union fell?
I think that this kleptocracy may be more brittle, may be more vulnerable than we think it is. I think there are possibilities of eventually down the road with enough pain inflicted from the outside, and I think sanctions make sense in that regard. Enough pain could bring, if not necessarily a popular uprising, not necessarily a Moscow Spring, then at least some kind of action by the powers that be. There still is a coterie of oligarchs and an old post-Soviet elite that values its prerogatives and its wealth and its access to the West. Putin has put that at risk. This has been a very much a riverboat gambler's foreign policy for him. But on the other hand, I think you're absolutely right. I think that Washington is thinking of itself as having to wait on something much more catastrophic, having to, in the end, concede in order to bring the Europeans around after things get considerably worse. But this, again, and the parallels are just striking. This is the toll of policies that began under Bill Clinton, were so mindlessly pursued, continued under Bush, and have been continued under Obama. It's not an accident that Putin can rally the kind of life-saving for him, a regime-saving support that he's got inside Russia because of the encroachment of the West, because of the humiliations that Russia has suffered. The sad part, of course, Ian, is that the Russian people are going to be paying the price here in a disastrous way with the price of oil and all the rest. This is going to be a very, very hard period for them. And I see no evidence, though, that the Ukrainians are up to the task. We mustn't forget this is an American-implanted regime in terms of its interior realities. It's still a very, very corrupt place. And again, the Maidan, the demonstrations in the streets belie the underlying political reality in the Ukraine. So it's rather a weak reed to lean on here. You're absolutely right. I think that there's not much choice but to go with the flow, to avert a shooting war, and to hope that Putin falls of his own rotten weight.
I thank you very much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the part and folly on Capitol Hill.